I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I don't know what's scarier, tonight's time change or Halloween next week. But let's start by screaming over some snakes on a plate. You can actually buy that dish in L.A. right now. Some think wines in a cardboard box are scary, but I might change those minds today. Amy Sedaris, actress and comedian, stops by with some real and not exactly real advice on entertaining. First, let's go to the farmer's market to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Hey, guess what? It's pumpkin time. And I'm not just talking about Halloween. I'm talking about the entire fall, holiday, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year season. Pumpkins are great table decorations. Pumpkins and their cousins, the squashes. We're with Barbara Spencer right now from Windrose Farm. She comes down from Paso Robles. She grows a very unique, very interesting variety of pumpkins slash squashes. And I know you're going to tell me they're the same thing, but you have everything from white to blue to orange, to green, to yellow. First of all, let's talk about the pumpkins you have, squashes.
Okay, first question is, all pumpkins are squash, all squash are not pumpkins.
Okay.
And in pumpkins, you've got the things that are kind of your happy little carvers and jack-o'-lanterns that are basically pretty hollow, you don't really want to eat. So weight is a huge issue. If you go to pick up something that's pretty heavy, you have a good chance of being able to eat it. What we tend to grow are edible squashes, ones that are great now, and many of them, particularly the larger ones that are really beautifully decorative for your front doors and center of a large table, actually improve with age. So the flavor gets better the closer it gets to the holidays. So there's some of these, like these peachy colored French pumpkins that are French pumpkins, the little warts and bumps, they actually taste better by Christmas. So it's kind of like this perfect thing where you can look at them, and just about the time you're ready to put up the Christmas tree is when they get really, really good.
Sweeter,
better texture, nuttier. Because what you get is a combination of nutty flavors, really creamy flesh in some of these.
All right, and the Cinderella. Let's just try to describe these Cinderella pumpkins. Yeah. It looks like Cinderella's pumpkin carriage.
They do.
Yeah, and they're big.
They're very big. And we have one at home. Somebody needs to reserve. We found this one out in the field. It's probably 80 pounds.
Ooh.
It's like the ultimate perfect pumpkin. It's this giant Cinderella. So it's great eating roasting squash. We really believe in roast them whole.
Literally throw the whole thing in the oven.
Yeah.
How hot?
You can do it 350 and then turn the oven off after about an hour and let it coast, or do it really slow for a while. And what we love to do is really let it sit overnight. We bake them ahead, roast them ahead, and they kind of, it's like meat, it'll reconstitute, the cellular structure will just get better and the flavors get better.
Put it in the oven at 350 for an hour, turn the oven off, and then just leave it there?
Yeah, you could do that. Or, you know, just things, we're talking about the big ones now. Small ones, you know, you just have to test it. It's like a giant baked potato. That's all you have to think about. You're doing a big baked potato.
So you pierce it with a knife, and if it's tender, it's done.
It's done. And you'll see the skin change color. You'll see it as it loosens, like butternuts. When they loosen from the stuff, you can tell that something's happened. And your nose will tell you, because you can smell them when they're cooked.
Do you put them on a cookie sheet because they drip all over the place?
Yeah, and I would put a little, no water, but put some olive oil underneath, simply because when they do drip, because even when you don't poke them, they will sometimes explode a little bit, and the sugars. If they're really good, there's sugar in them, and, you know, the olive oil basically just simplifies your cleanup. And we don't use water at all. We just stick them in whole, knock off the stems, and do it.
All right, Barbara, real quick, you know, we all love everything you have, but let's talk real briefly now about your roasted tomatoes and peppers that you do every year. They're so delicious.
Yeah, we're just starting now to do the smoke-dried tomatoes.
And what kind of wood do you smoke them with?
Apple and almond.
So interesting. Yeah, you have special wood that you smoke your tomatoes and peppers with. It's just great. And you do that right there on the farm.
Right there on the farm.
Right. Wonderful.
Well, you've seen it. It looks like this funny little Roman church.
Yes,
you know,
it does.
Yeah,
smoke stains. Okay, well, Barbara, your pumpkins are beautiful, and it's so nice to know we can buy them and leave them on the table and then eat them at Christmas time. That was Barbara Spencer from Windrose Farm, and she and her husband Bill farm up in Paso Robles. They're organic, and they have their beautiful displays of pumpkins, everything from the 80-pounder, well, today she probably had a 40-pounder, all the way down to little tabletop varieties. They're just gorgeous. In spite of the fact that most things in the fall are orange, Alex Weiser is growing some gorgeous, delicious Bloomsdale spinach. And Alex, why don't you describe what it looks like and how it tastes?
Okay, well, it's very thick and heavily savoyed, very crinkly, and it's sweet, and it doesn't have that tannin aftertaste that a lot of spinach has. and it doesn't shrink down as much. Very popular back east.
I had some a few weeks ago. It is delicious. It's mild. It doesn't make your teeth feel soft. Doesn't have that, like you said, that aftertaste. And what's the best way to cook it? I guess not.
Well,
much.
I just sauteed them with garlic, salt, yeah. and pepper.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't crazy about spinach until this Bloomsdale spinach, and I love it.
And this spinach, I mean, now that basically the big spinach E. coli scare has gone by, we did find out after all the media, right. you know, hysteria, that actually it was confined to several industrial greens growing areas up in Northern California.
Right.
You grow yours in where?
Mine's grown up in Tehachapi, up in the Southern Sierras, so it's we're in Kern County. We're at 4,300 feet. And, you know, it turned out perfect because we had planted our spinach maybe 3 weeks before this happened. So when that happened, that E. coli, I was like, oh, boy, what are we going to do? Should we turn it under? You know, my dad and I were discussing. But then I thought maybe this could be a blessing for us. People trust us and want to know where their spinach is coming from. And bottom line, this is one of the best tasting spinaches around. So people are now going for this spinach and trying it for the first time and realizing, boy, it is different.
Now, how long are you going to have it?
Well, we'll have it for another month, this crop, and then February, March.
Because it's going to go great with the fall squashes as side dish. You could put some toasted walnuts on. Oh, it's just a wonderful, wonderful. And you got the squash to go with it, too.
Oh, yeah,
winter.
We have fall.
This is great. We love fall. This is really wonderful. Okay, Alex, well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Alex Weiser, and he's growing this wonderful Bloomsdale spinach. It's a very wrinkly, he said Savoy. That means it's real wrinkly, very dark green, tender, and absolutely delicious. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Speaking of pumpkins, this is the time of year for squashes of all kinds, and nothing seems to fascinate us more than huge pumpkins. So meet Ron Wallace, grower of this year's champion pumpkin. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Is growing vegetables something you do for a living?
No, it's just a hobby that I've been doing for the past 16 years.
Is this the first year you've won?
It's the first year I've won the world's championship.
So what was the variety of pumpkin that you grew and how much did it weigh in?
Well, they're all Dill's Atlantic Giant seed. The seed that grew the world record, which was 1,502 pounds, was from a seed that I made up a few years ago, which came from a 1,068-pound pumpkin. This pumpkin put on 840 pounds during the month of August over a four-week stretch.
That is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, for a while there, it was doing 36 pounds a day, every day.
And in the process of trying to find the biggest, I would imagine you're carefully nursing several. Or does one immediately show itself that it's going to be one that's going to be the biggest?
I did 10 plants this year, and to do 10 Atlantic Giant plants, that requires quite a bit of work. I averaged about 30 to 35 hours a week on 10 plants. We had several pumpkins this year, over 1,100 pounds. I knew this pumpkin was special. When I pollinated it, it was the size of your thumb. 30 days later, it was 600 pounds.
That is just extraordinary. So what's going to happen to this pumpkin?
Well, a pumpkin right now is sitting in a refrigerator in the Bronx in New York, and it's going to be carved this Sunday at Grand Central Station.
How did you truck a 1,600-pound pumpkin to New York?
I rented a U-Haul, and I got it down there. I mean, we've been transporting pumpkins for years, so you have to be careful. They're on pallets, but they're cushioned with cushions, and they're strapped down, so you have to go slow. We put them in an enclosed U-Haul because in the back of a truck, even though it may have fit, it just is just too many people stopping and waving, and it's very difficult to drive, so...
Well, Ron, thank you so much for spending a little time with us this morning.
Have a good day.
That was Ron Wallace, hobbyist gardener and grower of this year's giant pumpkin. Amy Sedaris was the actress and writer behind the disturbingly funny Comedy Central series, Strangers with Candy. She's also a playwright and, of course, is the sister of the equally talented David Sedaris. It may surprise you to know that Amy Sedaris is a natural party giver. Even living with an imaginary boyfriend named Ricky, she manages to find the time to bake cupcakes and create interesting dinner parties. Her new book is a wacky and unorthodox take on home entertaining. Next, entertaining advice from one of the most original people on the planet. That's when Good Food returns. You may know her best as Jerry Blank in the television series Strangers with Candy, but to call Sedaris an actress or even a comedian is to shortchange her. A constantly changing performance artist may be more like it. So why is she on Good Food? Well, her new book on entertaining called I Like You is probably one of the most truthful books on the subject I've ever read. And reading truth about cooking and entertaining while laughing too much is, well, that's a great thing.
That's good.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Believe me, it's our pleasure. So have you always enjoyed entertaining?
I've always enjoyed entertaining, and I do cook. I cook a lot.
We should say, first of all, the book is extremely visual, and it's sort of like a scrapbook of the inside of your mind, which has to be a very interesting thing.
Disturbing. Disturbing.
You seem to spend a lot of time...
alone.
So that when you do choose to have people enter your world, you're very concerned with putting them at ease and giving them a lot of things to do so they won't get bored.
Yes, that's very important. You don't see any wires in my apartment. You don't see a TV. You don't see a stereo. You don't see the phone or hear it. So it's like a psychiatrist's office. You know, have a fake fireplace, you know, a little rabbit hopping around. Who doesn't like rabbits, right? So, you're very much at ease in my apartment.
I would imagine that one of the things you really must do in a very interesting way is deciding who to bring in and who to put together. How do you decide on a mix? What sort of mixes of people?
Do you smoke pot or do you not smoke pot? Let's start there. You know what I mean? No, you do have to think about that. Yeah, it's all about who you cast.
So do the holidays, Halloween and Thanksgiving, have particular meaning for you as crafty as you are?
I like them. I like the fall. That's my favorite season. I was just lucky enough to be in Asheville, North Carolina for Peak Week.
And what is that?
Peak Week is right the peak of when all the trees are changing. They were on fire. So I thought, oh, great. You know, I have an iron. I just need to go buy some wax paper. I'm going to iron my leaves between wax paper, which I hang up in my apartment every fall.
What happens to a leaf when you iron it between wax paper?
It sticks to the wax, you know, that's on the paper. So it's just pressed. And then so when you hang it up in a window, the light comes through and you just see the leaves. And it looks like it's in a frosty background because of the wax paper.
See, I love that because when I was a kid, we used to make our own wrapping paper, and we did it by shaving crayons in between two sheets of wax paper and then ironing.
Oh, you did not?
Yeah.
Really? I can do that in my hotel room. Great. Room service going to see. Oh, really? That's a good idea.
And speaking of irons, is it really true that you taught Martha Stewart how to...
Yeah, iron a grilled cheese sandwich. I
mean,
I
was doing Conan. When she was in prison?
Well, it was way before prison, you know, and we were doing Conan O'Brien together, and I asked them, I said, what is she going to be doing? And they said, she's going to teach Conan how to iron a shirt. And I said, okay, I'll teach him, you know, how to iron a cheese sandwich. You know, she ever goes to prison. And so that's what I did.
And did she end up using that knowledge?
I don't know. I didn't ask her. I bet she didn't. Can you imagine? BLT next. Can you imagine?
Now, every once in a while, actual real horrible life intrudes. Is there anything you can do with pets to sort of enhance the grieving process?
Oh, well, if it's a small pet, I make these little bags out of felt, grieving sacks. Anyway, you make these felt bags, and then you can put the ashes in it, and then you can do a felt cutout of the animals. So let's say you lost a mouse. It'd be a little cutout of a little mouse on the felt, and you put little ashes in there of your mouse.
But you still have you have a newer rabbit, a rabbit who isn't ashes. You have a catering company that you've named after Dusty.
Well, when I got my first rabbit, I said, you young lady, if you're going to live here, you're going to have to get a job. So I came up with my cupcake business. And so I sell my cupcakes, and I still do. And all that money goes into a jar, which is my allowance. And then for Dusty, she was living off that money. So I said, you've got to come up with another job. So that's when I started making cheese balls.
This isn't a joke. You actually really, really make cupcakes and cheese balls.
Out of my apartment, yeah. It's just something to do. It's a job. I can complain about butter. I can complain about the price of vanilla. And I can always say I have a job.
Who are your customers?
Oh, I'm a very busy woman. I mean, I'm a very, very busy woman. Well, Gourmet Garage now makes my cheese balls for me. So when I make them at home now, it's usually a special order, people who I've known for a while. And then for cupcakes, I make them whenever I want, and I just walk them right over and sell them at a coffee shop in my neighborhood.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Now, tell me about your cheese balls. What makes them special?
It's smoked Gouda, cream cheese, butter, steak at one's house, a little bit of milk, and you form a ball, and you roll it in crushed nuts. And you spread it on a Ritz cracker. But it has to be a Ritz.
But I know you're Greek.
Yeah, Greek. There's a lot of Greek food in the book.
There's a lot of Greek food in the book. But there's one recipe I've always seen and I've tasted places and I've been afraid to make it. But now that I saw it in your book, that fear is gone. And that's the, what is it, galactoboreco?
Oh, yeah, it's the milk pie.
Yeah,
it's
the milk
easy.
Pie.
It's just working with phyllo. And just it, all it is like, you know, when you make like a pudding, you know what I mean? And then you pour it into the phyllo little shell that you made. It's really simple. I love it. But that's a good thing to make for anybody, anything with phyllo, because people are intimidated by it. Like I am with egg whites. I can't – anything that says fold or peak, I freak out about. I'm just not good with egg whites, you know.
Oh, look what I just turned to here.
The Baked Alaska.
Oh, that's a Baked Alaska.
Yeah, see, that's egg whites, but I know how to make – I can make that because that was a cake I had my mom make when I was growing up.
Describe to us the elements of a Baked Alaska for those poor unfortunates who have never had one.
Well, the bottom of it is like you make a sponge cake, and then you put ice cream in some kind of mold or bowl, cover it with saran wrap, chill it. And then when you take it out, you flip it upside down, so it's a dome, and you put it the dome of ice cream on top of the sponge cake or brownie, and then you make a, what do you call it?
Meringue.
A meringue, and then you put it all over the cake, and then you burn it. You brown it on top with a torch, or you put it under your broiler. Did I describe that very well?
You described it perfectly.
That's
my favorite
dessert.
Just imagine the faces of people at your house who probably the last thing they expect you to serve them is a Baked Alaska.
Well, I let them do it. They enjoy it. They like the torch. I make them wear the goggles, you know. And I love it when people are good at it. So it's like the marshmallow when you're making, you know, bringing a marshmallow and you just want it black and on fire. I like stuff like that.
God, you're great.
Well, I mean, you know.
The next time I'm in New York, I have to come over.
Oh, my God. Bring roach spray.
Thank you so much, Amy.
Well, thank you. I didn't know you had a restaurant. That's so great. That's a full-time job.
Yeah, just a little bit. That was Amy Sedaris. Her new book, which is really wonderful, is I Like You. The movie Snakes on a Plane had to have one of the shortest pitch meetings in history. So if I told you snakes on a plate, could you get the idea of what the dish looks like? Our fearless diner, Eddie Lin, surprises us once again with the items he finds on restaurant menus in L.A. Next, those snakes I was talking about. That's when Good Food continues. Well, by now, of course, we've all heard about snakes on a plane. But what about snakes on a plate? Enter Eddie Lin, our ambassador from what he calls deep end dining, and many of us just call plain scary. So don't tell me that you found snakes on a plate.
You know, believe it or not, I did, and I didn't even have to leave the California state line to do it. In reality, I thought I would have to go to Arizona or Nevada or, you know, one of our neighboring states.
Because you thought it would be Latino food?
No, I thought it was one of these kind of, you know, cheesy, kind of quirky Southwest or whatever kind of cuisine that's kind of more of a novelty item than
like
anything.
Like a macho food.
Yeah, you know, the Rattlesnake Festival or whatever.
And you basically went looking for this because, of course, you wanted to write an article called Snakes on a Plate.
I wanted to hop on the whole New Line Cinema publicity machine.
So tell us where you found Snakes on a Plate and if it lived up to what you had in your head.
One of my first criteria was I wanted the snake whole, you know, as whole as possible. You know, visually, you know, that's one of my, you know, main goals, I guess, is to just eat the thing and know what I'm eating is, you know, right there.
Yes, because you have a sick and twisted mind.
Well, I like to think of it as, you know, appreciating the animal I'm eating. But anyway, the snake at the restaurant I went to, which is in Rosemead, called Phong Dinh, kind of a Vietnamese-Chinese fusion place. And they have snakes in several different ways prepared. But the kind of snake they use is a water snake. But unfortunately, they ground all their snake. Is that right?
So the snake was like mincemeat. It was like
correct.
Hamburger.
Right.
Snake burger.
Right. So it's unrecognizable, basically.
Well, what's the point of that?
I know. So I ordered it anyway just to try what the snake meat actually is like and tastes like and everything.
What color was it?
It was kind of like a fish, you know, kind of a white meat fish. So, you know, not really interesting, you know, kind of just like flaky white meat. But unfortunately, I couldn't really get what the taste was like because for some reason they thought they had to really, really over-season.
So did it turn out after exploring the menu a little farther that this particular restaurant just has a very heavy hand with spices, or was it something they felt they had to do to sort of take your mind away from the fact that you were eating snake?
See, that's a great question because this restaurant also serves quite a bit of other unusual, exotic meats. And, for example, they have rabbit, venison, goat, boar, frog legs, alligator, ostrich, kangaroo, and believe it or not, fox.
That's just...
Which is no longer on the menu, we found out.
That's good.
Because of the suspect source. Anyway, so we don't really imagine all this stuff is flying off the menu. Because what they really promote here, and it's on their sign and on their menu, and our waiter recommended it, you know, it was the first thing out of his mouth was, I would recommend our famous baked fish, which is a catfish. And as we looked around the room, it seemed every single table, these big families, every single one of these tables had this enormous platter of this baked catfish. And they ate it down to the bone. It was like a you know, one of those cartoon fish bones at the end.
Did you break down and order the catfish?
No, I didn't. We ordered so much food already that we didn't get to that. But I did order eel because that particular thing is served practically whole. It is presented, you know, all coiled, you know, around itself and everything with the head there and everything. So it was the closest thing I could get to having an actual snake-like thing on a plate.
And was that overspiced as well?
Unfortunately, I describe that as, you know, they might as well have, you know, got a bunch of lemongrass and weaved it to represent a snake because it was all you could taste was lemongrass.
Well, thank you very much, Eddie, for being so willing to go out there and just be like the true omnivore.
You got
to
have a purpose in life, Evan.
And I'm glad it's your purpose and not mine. Take care.
Thank you.
Eddie Lin's The Deep End Diner. You can read his exploits online at deependining.com. I'd have to ask an expert what goes well with snake, but chances are you ask anyone what they think of wines housed in a cardboard box, and they'll tell you how bad they are. Next on Good Food, I'm going to try and change your mind. You might find yourself buying a box of wine this weekend. Stay tuned. What's your immediate reaction when you go to a backyard barbecue or a picnic and you see a giant box of wine? That's a box of wine. Do you back away? Wish you had brought your favorite Syrah in a flask? Above all, are you reassessing your friendship with this wine-in-a-box buying person? Well, stop all that judgmental nonsense. Wine in a box is a new animal. Mike Steinberger is the wine columnist for Slate. He's going to open our minds to a new world of wine packaging. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Let's talk about the new wine in a box. Is the packaging really cool, or do we look at it and it looks like some sort of pallid, strange thing that we wouldn't want to touch?
No. Some of the packaging is quite attractive. One does have to get past this built-in bias we all seem to have against boxed wines. We all tend to associate that with the kind of drinking none of us really want to do. But the boxes are quite attractive. The tubes are fantastic looking, I think. They're incredibly handy for parties. They've got a nice handle. You carry them along. And they are appealing to winemakers for a variety of reasons. The lower price point wines, it's a very innovative way of packaging. It appeals to consumers. It has the benefit of being less costly to produce and to ship. So for those reasons, producers find them quite interesting, and the public seems to be responding very enthusiastically. It's the most booming sector of the American wine market right now.
Well, that's just so surprising to me. Now, what size are we talking about? Are we talking about liter boxes?
3-liter boxes.
So it's wine that you want to have for a party or wine that you and your other are going to consume every night at dinner for a couple weeks.
That's exactly right. It could be either or with wines, for instance, like Detour, which comes not in a box but in a tube. What you have is inside the tube, the wine is held in a plastic bladder, and this prevents the wine from being oxidized, so it can last quite a long time.
Now, who are some of the winemakers who are getting involved in this new packaging?
Well, you've got a variety of them. You've got the Australians have been all over it. You have, for instance, Banrock Station, which I thought their 2005 Chardonnay in a 3-liter box was quite nice. You have a quite popular brand in California called Black Box, which is also doing some commendable work. I mentioned before Detour. That's probably the most exciting arrival on the scene. Again, it's made in a tube of wine. It looks like a Morton salt container on steroids. That involves three of the biggest names in the food and wine world.
The entrance of the French into this new wave packaging is particularly interesting to me. I know the French have not had an easy time of it lately in the world of wine.
That is true. Actually, aseptic packaging has been quite popular in Europe, and you do find in French supermarkets a lot of wines that come in boxes. So, in fact, we are the new arrivals here. It's only just gaining acceptance here, something that has been quite widely used in France and in other countries in Europe for quite some time.
So the wines that they're putting in these tubes, they're wines that are comparable to what?
Well, for instance, the Detour, they produce a Mâcon Village, so you would be getting basically a $9 or $10 Mâcon Village. And if you, this is the equivalent of basically a 3-liter tube. It's the equivalent of four glass bottles, basically, four standard glass bottles. So it would be the equivalent of buying four bottles of Louis Jadot Mâcon Village, for instance.
Do you think that with this global wine glut that we're having, that this kind of packaging is going to help to sort of blow out some of that surplus wine?
It does help. It's making a small dent, a very small dent, I think. It's not going to correct the problem. Unfortunately, it's going to correct the problem is, for instance, in France, a lot of winemakers going into other lines of work. But it is making...
That's so sad.
It is. It is. It's very sad. The French don't drink nearly as much as they used to. Consumption in France has dropped something like almost 50% over the last 40 years. I don't think the new packaging is going to get them out of the pickle they're in, but it does make a small dent in this worldwide wine glut we're experiencing.
By percentage, do you think that these wines in a box, are they even reaching 1%?
Oh, I don't know what the percentage is, but they're very popular. In the U.S., the growth of this market has been exponential, over 100% growth annually recently.
Are any of the wines packaged for single servings so you could conceivably have a party and just fill up a bowl of ice and throw in like little juice boxes for children but for adults?
It's funny you should mention that because one of the most innovative firms pursuing this new packaging is an outfit called Three Thieves. They've come out with these 1-liter jug wines, which have proven to be wildly popular and quite good, actually, I have to say. And they have more recently introduced single-serving aseptic box wines, basically juicy juice for adults. And, they are quite interesting to look at. They're a little leaner and taller than your standard juicy juice box, but not so much different that one couldn't see your kid getting into a little bit of trouble. And in fact, I found my wife, who's a very modest drinker. I walked into the kitchen one day and found that she had popped one open. And her comment to me was, that these things are dangerous, and apparently so.
Well, Mike, it's been a pleasure. We look forward to having you back.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Mike Steinberger. He's a wine columnist for Slate. That's slate.com. We've been talking about wines in a box. Halloween's this week. It's the beginning of candy season and the signal to begin the holidays. I asked an expert candy maker to give us some ideas of Halloween candy fun for adults. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Ghouls and goblins will take over our streets in the form of small people asking for handouts. It seems that Halloween becomes bigger every year, so we thought we'd turn to one local candy and pastry maker to see how she deals with the holiday. Michelle Myers of Boule on La Cienega is with us this morning in the studio. So welcome. Right before we came on the air, you mentioned how it's a great time at the shop because it sort of allows you to relax a little bit and be a little less structured.
I think so. Halloween has always been one of my favorite holidays in the year. And I think it's a time in the bakery where everyone sort of lets their hair down a little bit, lets loose, and kind of becomes a kid again, making these different candies and specialty items for Halloween.
Let's talk a little bit about the holiday in general. Do you know anything about the history, about how people started giving candy out to each other?
Yeah, it goes a really long way back, actually. It's sort of an ancient practice in Europe. The less fortunate would sort of go door to door, putting costumes on and performing these sort of mini plays in hopes of getting food or drink or money. And so as the Europeans migrated to the United States, they sort of brought that custom with them. And in fact, in Ireland, during the late 1800s, they brought over the concept of Mischief Night, where you would sort of go around your neighborhood and perform all sorts of pranks on your neighbors. But then as it went on into the early 1900s, things started getting really out of control. And so the local civic organizations kind of took it upon themselves to try and bring things back under control. So they encouraged these kids to go from door to door and receive candy instead of doing their pranks.
Ergo, so was, tricks or treats.
Exactly, exactly. So some sort of Halloween extortion.
Now, do you make candy corn?
Yes, we
do.
You
do?
Yes.
Candy corn for me has always been something I love to look at, and I love to touch it because it clicks. It has that sort of way it runs through your finger and it clicks. But when I think about eating candy corn, I don't get really excited.
Yes, I'm sort of the same way too. But I think with homemade candy corn, you can really instill a lot of flavor and use sugar that's not so refined. You can put vanilla bean in it. You can even put cinnamon powder in it to really make it flavorful and something different.
So how do you make it? Are there tiny little molds?
No, actually, each candy corn is made by hand, is molded by hand. I remember one Halloween, I think we were so delirious from molding hundreds of candy corn by hand that someone started a contest to see who could make the tiniest candy corn. And one of the cooks won. But you almost had to get a magnifying glass, but you could see that it was still layered in, you know, the white,
so
the yellow, and
what,
red.
This so is this what food professionals do when they go over the deep end.
Exactly. That's exactly what happens.
See, what I would want to do is just use up all my dough and make one really giant,
yes,
candy corn.
That's happened as well.
So what other confections are you making that sort of are a take on the traditional? Do you do candied apples?
Yes, we do. We do caramel apples, which are another favorite of mine. We'll have some that are plain and some that are rolled with almonds. And also this year we're going to do something special for the adults. We have a fleur-de-sel caramel in our store that's very, very popular. And so we're going to do an apple dipped in that caramel with the fleur-de-sel.
Of all these confections, what do you think are the easiest for people to make at home?
I think the candy corn is a fun one, especially to do with your kids.
Would you like to share any tips with people who are planning to make some Halloween candy at home?
Yeah, I think a lot of people love to make caramel apples, and that's also a great thing to do with your kids, especially decorating it afterwards. But the problem is how to avoid burning sugar when it comes to caramel apples. And so a few really good tips is to make sure that you're using a heavy-duty pot. That way the heat distributes evenly in the sugar and a little bit more gently if you used a very thin pot. Also to have a candy thermometer on hand, especially one with a clip, because then you don't have to worry about the thermometer falling in or taking the thermometer out. And then a great tip also is to have a bowl of ice water that is large enough to fit your pot in. So when you have reached your desired temperature, you can immediately put the pot of caramel into the bowl of ice water and it stops the cooking immediately. And so you won't have burned sugar.
That way you don't have to use that bowl of ice water for your hands, which may become burned later on.
Yes, exactly.
Michelle, it's been wonderful having you here this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Michelle Myers from Boole. We've been talking about Halloween treats. I really encourage you to go check it out over the next couple of weeks. I'm sure her windows will be fantastic. The address is 420 North La Cienega Boulevard, right at Rosewood. And the website is Boole, Boulela.com. When an Ethiopian who's been adopted into a Swedish home goes back to Ethiopia, what does he find? Is he a stranger in his native country, or does he feel a kinship he hasn't felt before? Next, I'll talk with an acclaimed New York chef about his return to Africa. That's when Good Food continues. Noted New York chef Marcus Samuelson was 3 years old when he was orphaned when his parents fell victim to a tuberculosis epidemic that raged through his Ethiopian homeland. He and his sister were incredibly lucky. They found refuge at a Swedish field hospital in nearby Addis Ababa, where they were soon adopted by a young Swedish couple from Göteborg, Sweden. It was Samuelson's Swedish grandmother, professional chef, who inspired his love of cooking. Marcus is now chef owner of 3 New York City restaurants, including Akavit. He's written a beautiful cookbook about his travels to Africa called The Soul of a New Cuisine, A Discovery of the Foods and Flavors of Africa. I've asked him to join me on Good Food today to share a native son's experience as he discovers for the first time his homeland. Welcome, Marcus.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I was really struck by the preface of your book that was written by Dr. Desmond Tutu, who wrote some really marvelous things. And in particular, I was fascinated by his statement that a person is a person through other persons and that a solitary human is a contradiction in terms. Could you comment on how you saw that expressed in Africa? I would imagine that food plays quite a role.
I think food all over the world is something that everybody's proud of. And in Africa in particular, where a lot of the food, it's not necessarily restaurant food, it's more family food. And nobody really eats by themselves in Africa. It's always between 6 to 12 people eating approximately, and you eat with your hands, and you divide a lot of the foods around. And it's a lot of storytelling around those tables. And through food, I think a lot of stories are told. whether it's through the stories of trading or the stories where immigrants came and other people left, but it's all in these stories of the food.
Now let's talk for a moment about ingredients. Is there a commonality throughout Africa of staples that are used over and over again?
Well, the staple is probably the biggest change. If you start in Morocco, you have the couscous, the semolina couscous is really the staple, all the way down to Senegal, where the rice culture really starts. But half of Senegal is also a big on couscous. You go down to Ghana, and then you have something called kenke, the fermented sort of corn, almost look like tamales. Then you go to Nigeria, and the staple becomes fufu, this sort of mash, root vegetable mash that we can be done with different type of root vegetables, you see it in Nigeria and Cameroon. You go down then later on to South Africa, since it's such a diverse country, you see both rice and noodles, but you also see pap, which is polenta, essentially. It's same as grits or polenta. It looks the same, and it cooks very similar. Then you come up to Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and you see the same dish as pap, but it's in there, in Swahili, it's called ugali. You come up to the highlands of Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa, the staple changed completely to injera bread. And then you back up to Egypt, and then rice culture starts again. So Africa has many different staple foods. I think the similarities that Africa has, a lot of the food is eaten together, communal eating. A lot of the dishes have a lot of vegetables and stewed meats because, you know, food has to last for a lot of people. And vegetables is very important because every day you don't eat fish or meat. Not because of people are vegetarian, but it could be because of religious fasting or the fact that there's not a lot of meat and fish in every country, you know.
Give us an idea of the diversity. Maybe pick a couple of dishes from each of the four regions, north, south, east, and west.
Well, when I was in South Africa, the cuisine that I had no idea about, it's called Cape Malay cooking. And I loved that cuisine. And it's I can only describe it almost like as a milder Indian food, but it has also hints of noodles and dishes sort of from Indonesia, Malaysia, and India. That cuisine is absolutely fantastic. Obviously, in Mozambique, Angola, the Portuguese Africa, you have shrimp piri-piri or chicken piri-piri that you see throughout the Portuguese world. And if you're in Senegal, there is a dish called chepejen, sort of fish and rice, that is the main dish, and I love it, you know.
What is piri-piri?
Well, piri-piri is really, think about it as a light chili paste that you can use as a condiment, or you can marinate fish or chicken or meat in it. So it's red chilies, a little bit of olive oil, lemon juice, garlic, and some parsley and cilantro. And you sort of blend all of that together. And then you can just grill off your shrimp and brush it with a little bit of piri-piri, and it would be fantastic.
So when you went back to Africa, and I expect that doing this book, you spent more time there than you ever had before and traveled more thoroughly than you ever had before. What was that like for you personally?
So many things. You know, you feel like a native and a stranger at the same time, and it's something that is something I think about a lot because, I look obviously very Ethiopian, and when I feel in the market and walk around there, I feel very at home. But then yet, you know, my experience is a little bit different, so sometimes I'm just like any foreigner, you're a stranger. And in the book, that's actually an advantage that I don't understand all the culture, so I can talk about that. There is something in Africa, there's something you call in Swahili called Ubuntu, which you feel all over Africa. People are very friendly. People want you to experience what their family and what their culture is. And this warmth, this Ubuntu, you feel that all throughout the continent.
When you would come back from your travels in Africa and you were back at Akavit and dealing with a cuisine, the Scandinavian cuisine, that's a bit more austere, did you long to just break out and make some of these really gutsy African stews?
Wherever I've cooked, we always use the world as a platform. And there's a lot of dishes at Akavit that have Japanese origin or some of them that has South American or North American. So just from a chef's point of view, Africa is this last continent that we need to explore. Because as a chef, you want to have a bigger repertoire and you want to always be intrigued and stay curious and develop yourself.
Thanks a lot, Marcus. I'm so glad you went there, and I'm glad that you did this investigation. It's a beautiful book.
And, thank you so much.
I can't wait to cook from it, actually. That was Marcus Samuelson. He's the chef of the noted New York restaurants Akavit, AQ Cafe, and Ringo. He's written a beautiful cookbook about his travels to Africa called The Soul of a New Cuisine, A Discovery of the Foods and Flavors of Africa. Jonathan Gold is no stranger in his land. He knows more about all the cuisines of Los Angeles than anyone I've ever met. Next, I'll be back with our omnivore's choice for where to eat this week. That's when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. Once again, it's time for our hit of Jonathan Gold and his wonderful suggestion on where to go eat to expand our culinary territory. Where are we going today?
North Hollywood.
Oh, not the San Gabriel Valley.
It's a change. North Hollywood is one of my favorite restaurant neighborhoods because it's the absolutely most diverse. Like, there'll be a Latin restaurant of some kind, you know, often Peruvian or Mexican or Salvadoran. There will be an Armenian restaurant, and there will be a Thai restaurant. And it just goes on repeating, you know, Latin, Thai, Armenian, Latin, Thai, Armenian throughout the length of Sherman Way, at least until it hits the no business part.
So where are we going in North Hollywood?
We are going to Sri Siam Cafe, which is one of the oldest Thai restaurants in Los Angeles. It's almost 30 years old.
Wow.
One of the dishes they do here that it would seem like it's everywhere, but I've never seen before, is something called olua, which is a pancake. It's like a fried rice pancake. There's egg involved in it. It's sort of golden and it's crispy, and it has all those pleasant hot oil elements that you expect from great fried food. But inside, it's stretchy, chewy rice batter.
And are there nuggets of stuff in it, or is it simply the pancake?
There's shrimp in there. You get like a stack of, like a short stack, served on top of a big bed of sauteed bean sprouts.
Oh, that sounds great.
And there's a really nice chili sauce to splash it with. The effect is really close to the Vietnamese crepes you may have had, called Bancho, kind of like the perfect snacky appetizer. This place has other good snacky appetizers, including maybe the definitive version in town of angel wings, which are the chicken wings stuffed with stuff and deep fried and served with a sweet sauce and sliced and, you know, good. Not challenging, but really good. They have a almost perfect version of the Thai crispy rice salad, which has crispy rice, obviously, and peanuts and chopped scallions and other vegetables, and squares of the slightly sour fresh Thai sausage that I sometimes call Thai spam because it has many of the same characteristics. And that, again, has like a nice, spicy, light, lime-scented dressing.
It's got all the textures, too. It's everything. It's like crunchy, soft, fresh, funky, all together.
Exactly. And it's one of those dishes that I always say powers you to the bottom of the bowl because every bite is good, but you're always searching for the perfect bite, the one that has just enough peanut and just enough scallion and enough of the rice in it and like a little piece of the spam. And you get it and it's like, oh, too much spam in this one. So you take the next one and it's like, oh, that time I didn't get a peanut. And then you take the next one. And then before you know it, you can see yourself at the bottom of the plate.
What is that called on the menu?
It's called crispy rice salad.
Oh, yum. Okay, I have to go do that.
And they have a good crispy catfish salad, the one that looks something like a Thai rice crispy treat, but instead is minced catfish fried. A lot of their dishes have apple salad, which I assume started when the restaurant started, before you could get green papayas, is their version of green papaya salad made with Granny Smith's instead of green papayas. They've kept it over the years, and they put it on things like fried trout, for example. It works really nicely with the fish.
Sounds wonderful. So once again, tell us the name of the restaurant and where we can find it.
The name of the restaurant is the Sri Siam Cafe, and it is at 12843 Van Owen Street in North Hollywood.
Jonathan Gold's a food writer for the LA Weekly. You can listen to past episodes of Good Food featuring Jonathan Gold's restaurant suggestions on our archive page at kcrw.com/archive. Next, a food magazine based in LA turns 50, and to celebrate a book for the ages, Bon Appetit editor Barbara Fairchild joins me next to talk about the food and the recipes that define an era. Stay with me on Good Food. Bon Appetit magazine is 50 years old, and it's celebrating not just five decades of American culinary experience, but also the publication of an enormous book, the Bon Appetit Cookbook, which brings together more than 1,200 of the magazine's most favorite, all-time, best-loved recipes. So, of course, we have Barbara Fairchild, editor of the magazine, with us this morning. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Evan. Always nice to be here.
What makes a good recipe? And then what makes a recipe a Bon Appetit recipe?
Well, what makes a good recipe is ease and accessibility. People need to feel that they can do it, that it won't take a lot of time necessarily. And if it does take time, that the payoff will be there. What makes a great Bon Appetit recipe, I think what's always been our trademark, is to take a classic recipe, whether it's in a classic American recipe or something from Italy or Asia or Latin America or Mexico, and giving it a little twist, a special twist that brings it up to the next level, gives it a touch of sophistication, but still accessibility. You know, that's our three key words that we live by on the staff of Bon Appetit are accessibility, relevant, and fun. And I think that's what we do every month in the magazine, and hopefully this book reflects that, because this book is really, you know, it's really from the DNA of the magazine. We have step-by-step illustrations, a glossary of terms, and then, you know, 1,200 of our greatest hits, our nearest and dearest.
How do you even go about choosing what those are?
Well, we started in a logical place, which was with the staff, and we polled them to just, you know, give us a list of what recipes they remembered liking when they made them or tasted them in the test kitchen. We went out to our family and friends, and then we know from our readers through the years, you know, from the mail, from the email, from the phone calls, which recipes really resonated with them.
Was there a recipe that just popped up that so many people mentioned it, you just thought, wow?
The giant toffee coffee cookies we have, that was one that a lot of people remembered, I think because of the size and because of the lusciousness. A couple of roasts and turkey recipes, you know, I think the holidays are a time when the magazine really shines and our readers like to really shine. So there's a lot of taste memories going on there. And, you know, it's so funny, Evan, because we work so far ahead that we're testing our Thanksgiving recipes usually in July, you know, in the heat of summer. And it never ceases to amaze me. It doesn't matter. It could be 100 degrees outside, but people love eating turkey and gravy and mashed potatoes
well,
and stuff.
Because people just usually have it once a year. And then
exactly.
You forget that actually it's not that hard a meal to prepare. It becomes this laborious thing because so much family is involved. But if you're on your own, it's so much bang for your buck.
Or if you assign people things, which is what I do, because I find increasingly over the years, people really like to help.
Now, you are an editor, and most of what you deal with on a weekly basis, aside from, I'm sure, tasting a lot of what comes out of the test kitchen, is words. And yet you were telling me for the first time you found yourself cooking on television.
I did. It was quite an experience. I actually enjoyed it. It was last week I was in Chicago, and I cooked from the book.
What did you make?
I made a really simple green bean recipe that has orange zest and lemon zest, and actually is a recipe that I've speaking of Thanksgiving again, make for Thanksgiving for the last couple of years because you can do part of it ahead and it is so darn easy and delicious. Again, a sort of that characteristic Bon Appetit recipe. You take something as easy as basically steamed and lightly sauteed green beans and you add garlic and a little bit of butter and some orange peel and lemon peel, and it gives it that lift and that sort of that special twist that's so easy but really makes it a special dish. And we also had a really nice rosemary chicken that's in the book and some fabulous goat cheese mashed potatoes. I always like to say, Evan, that any cookbook that has 13 recipes for mashed potatoes and a lot of chocolate is something that you need on your bookshelf.
And I have to say that one of the chapters in the book, along with, you know, the normal meat, poultry, desserts, is potatoes. You gave potatoes their own special chapter. Now, is this also in response to what you see the readers clamoring for?
Partly. I think partly also it's just because all of us who work on the magazine love potatoes. And every time we have a testing with for a single story on potatoes or something that has a lot of potato dishes in it, everybody loves running into that kitchen.
Give us just a little breeze of a potato recipe, something from the chapter that you absolutely love.
Well, I do have to say I do love those goat cheese mashed potatoes, and that's one of the reasons that I selected them.
So is it just simply mashed potatoes into which you mash goat cheese?
There's goat cheese. There's a little bit of green onion in there to, again, give them a little bit of a lift, and, you know, salt and pepper, a little bit of garlic, as I recall, and then that soft goat cheese that you just stir in. You can use, you know, a mild flavored blue cheese if you don't have goat cheese on hand. And everybody just goes crazy.
Now, you've had so much experience. And to me, the amazing thing about being an editor of a magazine like Bon Appetit with the demographics you have is that there's so much interplay between the readership and your editorial staff. When you went to put the book together, what were some tips that you really wanted to include to make the whole idea of cooking accessible for what you call a newbie?
Well, I think that in order to make it as approachable as possible, what everybody wants to know these days is, what can I do ahead? So we were very, very cognizant of that. People need their hands held a little bit. And then once they get the confidence that they'll get from our recipes, then they can go on to the next step.
Barbara, it's a pleasure talking to you. As always, thank you so much, and congratulations on the anniversary and the publication of the new book.
Thanks so much. We're very excited.
You just heard me speaking to Barbara Fairchild, editor of Bon Appetit magazine, which is now 50 years old. Take a look at the new tome, the Bon Appetit Cookbook, which is 1,200 of the magazine's favorite recipes. The Good Food Podcast is available each week. Go ahead and sign up on iTunes to get the download automatically. You can also listen to the archive of this program or other shows when you go to kcrw.com. All the notes for today's show is on our new website at kcrw.com. You can sign up for the weekly newsletter, too. Just go to kcrw.com, click on About, and you'll see email newsletters in that list. Jennifer Farrow is the executive producer of Good Food. Today's show was produced by Bob Carlson, Thea Chaloner, Holly Tarson, Candace Moyer, Priya Fenimore, and Marina McLeod. I'm Evan Kleiman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.